Let's go to our Asia correspondent, Ed White, who's with the Financial Times based in Shanghai. Probably know more about, probably more than you want to know about a shipping service in New Zealand right now, Ed, but it's very important to the people of the Chathams. Thanks for your patience. Look, what's been happening with respect to some of the geopolitical shifts of late in China that you've got your eyes on? Obviously, globally, we've all got our eyes on.
So, yeah, good morning, Catherine. I think one thing that's happening at the moment is right now we have a very top Chinese official. This is Zhao Leji, who's the third ranking member of the Communist Party's very top leadership group and a close aide and ally of Xi Jinping. He's been dispatched to Pyongyang, North Korea. And this is to really, to quote the Chinese officials on this, to reassert China's deep friendship with North Korea. But behind this visit is really a lot of concern rising actually in both Beijing and Washington over North Korea and in particular Kim Jong-un's strengthened alliance with Russia and with the Russian leader Vladimir Putin. So while the Chinese foreign ministry hasn't really provided much detail about this visit, the analysts and experts that we're speaking to say that this is really signaling Beijing's discomfort over China, Russia's rising influence on the Korean Peninsula. And so for a bit of context here, this is a really quite historic shift that we're seeing. So over recent months, Russia has started supplying oil directly to North Korea. This is obviously in defiance of long-running international sanctions, which I think New Zealand is now going to be increasingly involved with monitoring these sanctions. But these sanctions are all obviously designed to deter the development of nuclear weapons. Russia in late March also vetoed the extension of a really crucial UN panel that monitors compliance with sanctions on North Korea. And for its part, and this is the real key change, the Kim regime has actually been providing a lot of support for Putin's war effort in Ukraine. So North Korea has been supplying thousands and thousands of containers of munitions to Russia and consistently also backing Moscow at the United Nations. So this strengthening of the Kim-Putin relationship has really raised a lot of questions around how Kim Jong-un, who's now 40 and is obviously going to be ruling in North Korea for the rest of his life, how he might start to play Russia and China against each other. And it also really takes the region back to the Cold War. The last time North Korea had two patrons in both Russia and China was really that long ago. And it was a time in which North Korea was able to have quite a lot of success in doing that. So that's different from the last 20 years or so, where they've just been reliant on China. And really, you know, since the failure of that summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un in Hanoi back in early 2019, North Korea has obviously made its intentions quite clear to improve its nuclear weapons capability. And a key concern now is that, you know, Kim Jong-un might, with this extra support he has from Russia, he might be emboldened to carry out higher risk weapons tests, including a new nuclear test. And that hasn't happened since 2017. And this is really, really tense and really a big problem because that's a red line, not just for the US, but for Beijing as well. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of this trip from Zhao Leji to Pyongyang. He will be delivering a message from Xi Jinping. We probably won't find out exactly how that's unfolded, but we might start to see in the coming weeks and months whether North Korea is going to sort of back down from the path that it's on and perhaps pivot back towards China.
South Korea had legislative elections this week. Can you reveal what they tell us about things?
Yeah, really a stunning defeat for the right-wing conservative bloc in South Korea. This is the bloc under President Yoon Suk-yeol. This conservative right-wing group has been kind of tenuously in power here. President Yoon only won by a whisker in the presidential elections 2 years ago. And after the polls closed on Wednesday, it looks like the main opposition Democratic Party of Korea, so this is the sort of the left-wing group, which is more favorable to North Korea and more sort of anti-US involvement in the region, they are projected, I think, to win more than around 176 of the 300 seats, and that compares, I think, to around 109 seats for Yoon's ruling for the People's Power Party. So these numbers are important because it means that the Korea's sort of left wing bloc did not quite achieve the 200 seat threshold that would have basically given them the ability to block the presidential veto in South Korea. But this gap between the left and the right wing blocks, the sort of the victory by the left wing, is now, I think, one of the largest that Korea has had since the transition to democracy in the 1980s. And look, this just reflects a huge amount of angst in South Korea at the moment over a couple of key issues, which might sound familiar in New Zealand as well. So the cost of living crisis in South Korea is really problematic. And that's feeding into a worsening demographic crisis. So people may be kind of familiar now that South Korea has one of the lowest fertility rates in the world. I think it's projected to fall to something like 0.68 this year, and that's far below the 2.1 that the OECD says is what's needed to ensure a sort of stable production. And so in terms of what this means also on the sort of international front, The defeat was so resounding, really, that Yoon, who, as I said, only came into power in 2022 and has three more years of his presidency left, he's basically facing the remainder of his presidency as a lame duck with very little political power, very little capital to get anything done on the domestic front. That said, in the Korean system, you know, like in the US, foreign policy is really in his hands, in the president's hands. So it's unlikely in the short term his key policies of remaining very positive on the South Korean relationship with Japan and the US will change. But as I said, on the domestic front, he is really going to struggle to get anything done.
Just a bit over 2 minutes to touch on a pretty major issue at the moment. The Japanese Prime Minister has been in Washington, D.C., and these geopolitical realignments, this is another interesting strand of it.
Yeah, so there's obviously, I'm aware there's been a lot of discussion in New Zealand over the pros and cons of potentially joining in some capacity the AUKUS security pact, which is obviously all aimed at boosting a deterrence against these perceived threats of China's expanding military assertiveness and what some people think is aggression in the region. But a story that's probably gone under the radar, so to speak, is that there's actually been quite a historic upgrade of the security relationship between the US and Japan. And this is currently kind of unfolding while the Japanese Prime Minister, as you said, Fumio Kishida, he's in Washington meeting with President Biden there. So, you know, as we've talked about, Catherine, over the last couple of years, there's been a long-term process underway in Japan, driven really by the late Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, to steadily increase military spending, steadily improve Japan's security capabilities. But a key piece of the puzzle really that's been missing is that in the real world, the Japanese military and defense organizations just don't really cooperate or coordinate very much with the US or with other allies in the region. And this is, remember, there's still something like 55,000 American troops based in Japan. So what's been happening is that the Japanese and the Americans have really at the highest level between the country's leaders have been agreeing to change the military command and control structures of the military agreement between the two countries. They're going to give Japanese military leaders more involvement, moving to better link the Japanese and the US military operations around the region. They're going to be doing more intelligence sharing and also increased cooperation around defense technology and developing missiles. So really, this is a major, major shift. This hasn't been looked at for about 60 years, and I think is probably the biggest upgrade to the relationship that we've seen since 1960.
It really is, when you consider the history, don't you? It really does feel like we are in a time of very dramatic shifts in alliances and allegiances and the sort of the balance thereof. Thank you, Ed. Always appreciate your time. Ed White, Financial Times, based in Shanghai.